For the record, it is 3:07, Tuesday, March 10th. Joining us today, Representative Cisna, Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Coghill, and myself, Bob Heron. This meeting is teleconference today. We are taking public testimony. If you do have a cell phone, please turn it off. And we have two businesses to take care of today, and the first purpose we'll take up today is House Joint Resolution 10, a resolution to urge the United States Congress to improve health care for veterans. So Mr. Walsh and Mr. Colbert, do you wish to testify in front of the committee?
Which bill are we going first?
Normally we ask the sponsor to get up, but since you've shown up in uniform, we'll extend the courtesy that you comment on Representative Gutenberg's legislation first. And please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
My name is Howard Colbert. I'm the first junior vice for the Department of the State of Alaska, and I'm also commander of the local Disabled American Veteran Post, Chapter 4, here in Juneau.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
And my name is Mike Walsh, and I'm the adjutant for the Disabled Americans Chapter 4 here in Juneau.
Okay. Again, we have Representative Gutenberg's House Joint Resolution 10 before us. Do you wish to make comment on this?
Oh, yeah. I'm with the Disabled American Veterans, and according to the language of this here, or what I've read on this here, it says for rural areas and native areas and so forth like that. And the Disabled American Veterans, we do not discriminate against color, religion, creed, anything. We're all brothers. And to put this before another veteran is, I mean, it doesn't make sense, because what you're doing is you're discriminating against all of us. We are all brothers. Show me a veteran that has been in combat, and you'll find a brotherhood that it just, you can't break. Also, some of this stuff was written by a fellow from Virginia. Well, we don't live in Virginia. The logistics here in Alaska are a nightmare. The costs of moving around in Alaska are a nightmare. We don't even have a hospital in the state of Alaska. We have a clinic. However, we're in the process of opening up a couple more clinics. Only God knows when. I've worked with Beth Petula on several years about being able to find cares for veterans throughout Southeast Alaska. That's basically where I'm more familiar with. And, you know, we tried a lot of things, and we're still stabbing at it. When we first started, there was probably about this much water in the bottom of a glass. After all these years of working for veterans, we probably got the glass halfway full. And we have more veterans per capita in the state of Alaska than there is in any state in the Union, the lower 48. But yet we have less benefits. We have less rights. But yet we spill our blood on the battlefield more than anybody else. and we get less credit than anybody else.
Okay, let me go for it. Okay. Hi, I'm Mike Walsh, and as I was reading over this and earlier, and then also I went and because it made reference to the Veterans Health Care Budget Reform and Transparency Act of 2009 that was introduced in the House. That's H.R. 1016-IH. And I looked through both of those to see what, you know, what the importance of both of these were. And if I could just, you know, make reference to some of them. The first one talks about the Alaska State Legislature urges the United States Congress to provide adequate funding and resources to enable Veterans Health Administration to properly care for health care needs of all veterans by adopting a method similar to the proposed Veterans Health Care Budget Reform and Transparency Act of 2009, which was the one I had just referenced. So I read that, and basically it refers to the Comptroller General in making a budget that would coincide with the President's, you know, budget items and all that, because apparently they're saying that what happened was that they would, there isn't necessarily something, an amount budgeted for them. So they have funds, and then once those funds run out, then the veterans care drastically drops. And so what they're wanting the Comptroller General to do is to come up with a set budget that will hopefully cover all of that. And so I think that's your recommendation, from what I can see and hear. States that's one of the things that you want to do is to go to Congress and saying, we want to make sure that there's adequate funds to cover all the veterans' needs. So that's something that we would support. The other one says that you also urge the United States Congress to provide the United States Department of Veterans Affairs with sufficient, timely, and predictable funding for veterans care programs. Which, in a sense, is pretty much the same thing that we were talking about a moment ago, which is good. The desire, I know for us veterans, is that sometimes we don't get the care because they say, well, there's not the funding available to, you know, like, well, we'll get you, or, you know, you can get to the hospital, we'll take care of you there in the clinic or whatever, but we won't provide the funds to get you there or whatever. So sometimes veterans have had to do that on their own and then go back and try and get the money for that. Also, you are urging Congress to increase funding for research in the traumatic brain injury, or TBI, which, as I understand, especially with the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, that injury is on the increase quite a bit because of the IEDs and everything else. There are more of the TBIs, or the traumatic brain injuries, that we're seeing, which not only which also goes into the next one, which well, the other one down there talking about the mental health centers. The TBI is in conjunction with the mental health issues. And so that's an important thing for us, especially with the new veterans that are coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. What's that? Go ahead.
Also, the way that this thing is written, too, is facilities. In the lower 48, of course, you have your hospitals, your mental health hospitals, and they have domiciles for people that's going to be there. Never seen a domicile here, much less a psychiatrist or a analyst to help veterans that is actually knows what they're doing. Basically, these poor guys have to go to these people that doesn't have a clue. Right here in Juneau, we do not. I mean, as large as Juneau is, we don't have a psychoanalyst here who has any combat experience whatsoever. Much less if you're living in Sitka, Hoonah, or what have you. Where do they stay when they come and see one of these doctors? That's all written into this thing here. Since the war started, there's been 540,000 medals given out in Iraq and Afghanistan. For each medal, there's a consequence. There's a part of a man's life that has totally changed. Now, we live in a whole different world here in Alaska, but yet those veterans have made the sacrifice, and they deserve the benefits. They paid for the benefits. They should be able to use the benefits. Logistics shouldn't fit in here. Go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, and then the final one that I saw was in the last part there, where it said that you support federal and state funding and other efforts to ensure that the veterans across the state have access to quality health care at community health centers and community mental health centers, substance centers, tribal health organizations, and other appropriate local providers in the outlying areas. One of the things that we do as disabled veterans here in Southeast is we have an outreach program where we travel around to the different smaller communities where there are veterans who can't access some of the things that we do. So we go out there, we help them to work on their claims, to see that they're getting the health care that they need as well. So I think that with us, we're getting, my understanding is there will be a clinic in Juneau, and I believe one in Sitka, is that correct? I don't know, but I believe there are the two in Southeast right now. But there are still a lot of other smaller areas where, people would have to travel a great distance. And you get into the interior, it's the same thing. And so if they can get the care that they need right there in their community without having to travel great distances and take time off of work and everything else, that's what we would like to see eventually happen.
We're in new times in a new world. What a lot of people don't realize is we have a lot of women that are in service. Women are doing things that they've never done before. And when you traditionally look at this, it's kind of like a man's thing where most of the stuff is geared towards men. But that's not today. Today they've opened the very first PTSD clinic in Mallow Park, California, and it's just for women. It's just for PTSD. Well, we have a lot of women here, and there's absolutely no facilities for women in combat. Fort Rich, they have a lot of women there. What are you going to do with the women? They're soldiers, but still they're women, and this is going to be a problem that you guys are going to have to kind of sort out, and you really got to think about. You don't want people who are in the service to have to do without services because no one thought about it before the start of the war. For the rural health area, the VA has allotted $22 million in health care. But they sure haven't said anything about the state of Alaska for any of that money. If so, they're not telling anyone about it.
Okay. Conclusion here?
I was just going to say that the only other thing is that the electronic claims, and that's a good thing, I guess, as long as, there's secure, efforts made for the, privacy of the claimants and stuff. So, but that's it.
All right. Thank you for your testimony and thank you for your service to our country.
Okay, thank you.
Please note for the record that Representative Seaton and Representative Holmes have joined us several minutes ago. And at this time, I'd like to ask Representative Gutenberg to come to the table.
Oh, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Your glasses. Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We had Lisa Bukowski, Senator Bukowski, before us at a joint session. And she told us when she was asked about these resolutions, she said, keep telling us what to do. Keep sending them. So we need to be reminded about what Alaskans' issues are, and, you know, somebody's reading them. It's considerable that the veterans in the state of Alaska aren't getting the health care that they need. With the inadequate facilities, inadequate delivery systems, and many times, like the gentleman before me talked about, distance is a problem, not just in rural Alaska, but in urban Alaska as well. And the whereases, I think, in the report speak for themselves. What we want is we want to make sure that our VAs have services where they live, if it's possible, whether it's through VA facilities, whether they're there or not, or other facilities. We want better cooperation between agencies. You know, many times VA veterans have to travel distances when there's an existing facility in their community, and there are some additional clinics opening up. But still, if you don't live in a community with a clinic, a VA clinic, you have to travel to one, and that's a hardship all by itself. Funding is also a challenge on veterans benefits issues, these medical issues. It seems like the population is aging for those of us with gray hair. For new populations of vets coming out, there are all new kinds of challenges. So these gentlemen, these veterans and men and women in our service have earned these health care benefits of all kinds, and they should be able to get them without undue hardships. We're just urging Congress to do a better job than they have been doing right now.
Okay. Is there questions for the representative from the committee? I guess Representative Gutenberg, they're in the packet, and we'll deal with that at the appropriate time. I have offered up an amendment. Could you please state your comments on that at this time?
Oh, my pleasure. You know, you and I, we had a conversation about it, and you asked me about this, and you said that the amendment was going to be succinct and boil it right down, and that's pretty much what it does. I support the amendment. The services should follow the veteran instead of the veteran having to go sometimes great distances to get benefits that they're due.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll take action on it after we've heard testimony from others. We have three in the room and on this piece of legislation. So at this time, Shelley Hughes, if you could please come forward and state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Shelley Hughes with Alaska Primary Care Association. And before I represent the Primary Care Association, I'm the mother of a C-130 pilot in the Air Force who's had three tours to Iraq, and the wife of a veteran who was a medic in Vietnam. So this is near and dear to my heart. On behalf of the association, I do want to testify that this is an important resolution because we have been working with the state health VA health director, Alex Spector, for over a year and a half, and have not made a lot of progress. We've had a lot of contact with Senator Murkowski's office also. The concern about the veterans in the outlying areas who don't have access to a VA health care facility. What is happening is either they're not getting the care they need, because unless the needed treatment is related to the service, their service in the military, meeting certain criteria, which is actually relatively few. So if a veteran has something like a strep throat, they're not going to get that travel paid. And so they're either not going to get the care they need, or they're ending up in the community health centers or the tribal clinics, and they are getting treated, but there's no reimbursement. And that's one of the things we've been trying to work as the amendment, let the care follow the service. And it's been very, very slow. And so we believe there the federal agencies by Congress need to be urged to work together, a partnership between the VA administration and the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level to streamline this process so that arrangements can be made quickly. This is a time with young veterans returning, with the mental health issues. We have aging veterans with increasing health needs of diverse types, and they need to have the care, and they deserve it. And one of the things I want to mention, too, about the local care in the community, there's a real benefit, especially for these young veterans with psychological issues, is that, for instance, Community Health Center is a family clinic. And so that wife, the children, the family members can be seen, and things can be addressed in a way, perhaps, that a veteran going into a VA center by himself, where the wife might not be able to tell something that she's concerned about that she's seeing. So there's a real advantage and benefit to that. I just thought I would mention that. So I appreciate your hearing this resolution. I believe it's an important one. I don't know what we can do to shake up Washington to get something going, but this is a good start. So I appreciate and thank you for the resolution.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next person that's in the room that wishes to testify, Angel. Angel, if you could please come forward and state your full name and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Evangeline Angel Dodemain. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. Co-chairs and committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. First of all, I'd like to say that ANHB supports HDR 10, and we support the amendment that's been presented. We support our veterans and all of those who serve our country with such great courage. And we also support the amendment to ensure services and funding follow the veteran. We're pleased and honored that we, within Tribal Health, have the opportunity to serve our veterans. What is always so concerning to us is that we provide this service with no reimbursement. And we're pleased that this resolution and the amendment will encourage the VA to continue to work with Tribal Health System and Community Health Centers to ensure that the services that are needed and that we can provide are provided to all of the veterans within the state of Alaska. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, I believe the last person to testify, McHugh, could you please come forward and state your name and affiliation for the record?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is McHugh Pierre, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Legislative Liaison, and I'd like to just commend all the fine speakers you've had before you today, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. They've really put the nail on the head of the issue here, and Ms. Dodemain mentioned something very specifically that's important, and that's a matter of funding. And we, as the state of Alaska, have been able to work very closely with Senator Lisa Murkowski to try to bridge that gap between the VA and the BIA sharing those federal dollars. It hasn't quite been able to be accomplished. So we really need this action to send a clear message, and hopefully we can, you know, finish that final yard and get into the end zone. So we certainly appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman, and we urge support from the members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Any questions for the department? Seeing none, Representative Gutenberg, if you come to the table, give you an opportunity for a final summary before we take action on this resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do appreciate the time and effort you've put into it and the focus that this gets. Certainly sponsoring the veterans, both men and women, and rural and urban, deserve the recognition and the benefits that they have served for. Both Senator Murkowski and Senator Baggage, who will come before us, I think, April 7th for a joint House and that other body session. I think these are important issues for them as well. It gives them ammunition to do the job back in D.C. to stand up. And I'm sure there's other, and I know for a fact there are other states with veterans across the nation that have this problem.
Okay. Any Questions seeing none. Before us, we have committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 10, Military and MLV, and that's the S version. Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment, 26LS0313S1, by yourself, Representative Herron, to HGR 10, CS HGR 10.
Is there any objections to the amendment? Seeing none, amendment is approved. Mr. Co-Chair, move the bill from the committee.
Oh, just the housekeeping?
No, move
oh,
it.
Oh, move it? Okay. I'm sorry, I drifted there a little bit. I'd like to make a motion to move, see, it's CSHB.
HCR.
It's right here. Well, one right here. HCR, okay. HCR 10 MLV, version 26LS0313, version S. I'd like to move that we move it with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
As amended?
As amended. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Seeing no objection, the bill is from committee with individual recommendations. Thank you,
thank
sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. Ladies.
Okay. At this time, we're getting ready for our next on the presentation. Mr. Co-Chair, you have some housekeeping to take care of for the next meeting?
Thanks. Got ahead of myself. I just wanted to let the committee know that on Thursday we'll be hearing HB 2 and HB 20 if the House schedule allows us, the floor session allows us, and so that's what's on the slate. Thank you.
50.
Yeah. I've been corrected. That's HB 50, not 20. HB 50 and HB 2. Got that right? Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, HB 2 is stillbirth.
Yes.
And HB 50 is
nurses.
Is nurses overtime.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Next, we're going to hear a presentation by the Alaska Brain Injury Network outlining cost-effective and best-practice solutions to help people with brain injury. Presenting Christy Artuso, the Director of Neuroscience Services at Providence, and Jill Hodges, Executive Director of Alaska Brain Injury Network. And we do have a couple of people that are online that will testify after the presentation. So, Christy and Jill, if you want to come forward and begin your presentation.
Yes, hi. For the record, my name is Jill Hodges. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Brain Injury Network. First, I'd like to say thank you for last week. We heard Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 launching March's Brain Injury Awareness Month, and I think there was some really good discussion around prevention. And I thank you for hearing this topic today so we could really focus on some concrete, best practice, cost-efficient solutions. Right now, recognition has taken place in the military. They understand that TBI is going to be a challenge they're going to be dealing with. But also the tribal system is starting to learn that 34% of TBI survivors are Alaska Native, and our legislature and state have been working towards building brain injury programs here locally. And so what we're going to do first is watch a short video. Will and Jenny are both Alaskans, and we thought it would be a good time to introduce them. And then Christy Artuso will take over from there.
Matt, do you want to turn down one of the lights, please? Thank you.
Do you know why this isn't working this time? Oh, there,
there was no reason to believe this was any worse than any other spill we've taken.
Went off the first jump, the front tire, my dirt bike hit the second, and then I hit my head in the third.
Except that he didn't get up.
I injured the front right side of my brain. And I guess it was a deep one too, so I don't know how deep, but that's another reason why I had a severe brain injury.
He was taken to the hospital. He didn't regain consciousness, so he was at the hospital within probably a half hour of the accident, and that was a little after 9. By noon, he was in surgery. It was a 3-hour surgery. He had several vessels in his brain that were bleeding and a lot of injured tissue. There was no actual cut to his, no break in his skull. There were nothing broken on his entire body. No scratches. I mean, there was no physical evidence externally as to why he was not conscious until they did the MRI or actually CAT scan.
After I woke up out of a coma, I didn't remember anything before it, but after I woke up, I couldn't talk and I couldn't move my left leg.
He was kept in a medicated coma for 12 days. He was brought out of his medicated coma on the 13th day after they'd been monitoring and watching the brain swelling, seeing that it was reduced. And when he awoke, we learned that he couldn't move anything on his left side and he couldn't speak. So that process was the rest of his time in the hospital. He was in the hospital for 47 days. It wasn't until about a day after he woke from his coma that we actually figured out how to communicate with him. And he started it in sign language. And one of the first things he did in sign language, the nurse asked him a couple things about counting, and he was able to hold up fingers to indicate matching. You know, can you tell me 1? Can you tell me 2? Etc. So, he was doing a variety of those things, and then he just on his own voluntarily did this, which is, I love you. That was a pretty awesome moment.
Well, I have a brain injury that I received in a car accident about 4 years ago.
One of the greatest difficulties of having a brain injury is that it's an invisible injury to the naked eye. Most people who have a brain injury look fine. They are walking among us every day, and no one knows it until they start to demonstrate inappropriate behavior, or you find out that they're not working and there's no apparent reason why they should be off or unemployed.
My brain injury was diagnosed roughly 4 months after the accident, where I was told by a neighbor that I should go and have neurological tests run for the possibility of a brain injury, and sure enough, after the tests, they had diagnosed me with 6 to 10 years of healing. I immediately noticed that something was wrong in school. I returned the spring semester to take my fall finals, and believe I failed them all. And obviously, with a 4.0 GPA, there was something wrong, there's something missing. And besides that, my family members definitely believed that I had changed quite a bit. My personality had altered so much that they had also been quite concerned that there was something happening inside of my brain.
Usually what happens is that families notice first. So, and I would say employers and schools notice second. So a person has a car accident, let's say, and they hit another vehicle or stationary object at 45, 50 miles an hour, and they have whiplash and injury, and then maybe they also hit their head on the post or something. They go to the ER, and they're told, you might have had a concussion, but we're going to do a CT scan, and there's nothing wrong with your brain that we can say structurally. So, you know, take it easy tonight, just put your feet up, relax, and you should be fine within a week or so. What's not commonly recognized is that the person has sustained a mild traumatic brain injury, most likely, and that they may experience anywhere from 6 weeks to a year of recovery from that. And inherent to that recovery process is going to be problems with depression and anxiety, mood and personality changes, loss of function to some regard. As I said, you can go to work and you can kind of muddle through your day, but you're just not staying on top of your game as well as you have been before. And maybe you're fighting a lot more with your spouse, or you're being a more strict parent or a less involved parent at home. And so families start complaining and saying things like, you're just not the same as you used to be. Why aren't you doing the same things? What is going on with you? And no one can really pinpoint what it is, and so they'll start to do the circle of going to primary care, going to a psychiatrist, going to a therapist, looking for an answer as to what's going on. And if you do a careful history, you might be able to go back in time a few months, maybe even a year, and say that, geez, this person probably had a pretty significant injury. It wasn't recognized and documented properly, but they've been struggling since, and it's pretty clear that that's related to a brain injury.
I guess there's a bunch of different types of brain injuries. And I just found out, last week that I guess I had a severe one. I didn't know there was different kinds.
Different tiers of brain injury, which is important to know ahead of time. There's mild, moderate, and severe. And for a mild brain injury, the most important thing to know is that there can be a full recovery from that. Statistics suggest anywhere from 80 to 90% of people who sustain a mild traumatic brain injury are going to recover fully to their previous level of functioning. And so that's important for a survivor and the family to know, because just knowing that you're going to get to the other side of it is going to be something that's going to keep you going in your rehab efforts or in your medication therapy or in your individual talk therapy. The moderate and severe, it's important to know that the first 2 years after the injury are the most important for the recovery efforts. And then after that, what you're dealing with is going to be more long-lasting or permanent damage. Permanent losses or deficits. So in the world of rehab and recovery, what we want to do is get in there as quickly as possible and start to do some kind of therapeutic intervention.
Well, the largest part of my diagnosis was memory, and knowing that they definitely recommended memory exercises, whether short-term, like studying for a test, or long-term studying for finals. So I have been for years working on that in many different ways. I basically study a lot more. I go over things many more times. But I do work on my memory by reading the newspaper, recalling what I read to family and friends, also events that happen just during my everyday life. I try to, weeks or even days down the road, try to recall as much of the information as I can, which has definitely helped in improving my memory over the years.
Right now I'm doing OT and brain focus. I used to do like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech, acupuncture, counseling, and I think that's it. But before my accident, I used to like play sports and do everything, and then after I had my accident, I can't really do much. I play wheelchair sports now. And I go to therapy, and it's really boring. Like, I think it takes all the leisure time out of my day.
A key component to all of this is case management, and that needs to be really the mantra of any kind of rehabilitation effort. Case management is the centerpiece of all of that. A good case manager has a working knowledge of brain injury and the rehab process, and that person is going to be able to direct the process from beginning to end and know what specialties need to be pulled in at what time, and know how to get those services at least partially paid for, because financial issues are huge with this kind of problem.
The sports that I'm doing right now are wheelchair sports, and they're really fun. And I got to know new people, and I'm really good at them.
I think the biggest idea with traumatic brain injury is prevention. Prevention is obviously the biggest help we have in preventing people from sustaining traumatic brain injuries. But for those who do receive traumatic brain injuries, services are of the utmost importance. They are really not only the tool to discovering and diagnosing traumatic brain injury, but they're also the key to helping those for the rest of their lives, whether it may be a short time or for a lifetime.
We were pretty excited that Will and Jenny were able to speak and advocate. Jenny's from Fairbanks and Will lives in Anchorage. And I'd just like to point out a few things with Will and Jenny. One is at this point in their life, one's in Hawaii traveling on a study abroad program. The other one's in Costa Rica on a missionary program right now. And they've been having rehabilitation efforts for many years, and they're at a level where they're able to function in school and able to be the best they could be, really. And the point of our discussion today is to highlight three programs. One is a funding solution to help people with brain injuries have access to the care they need, how to develop these programs in Alaska, and also how to arrange some case management so more people could have access to the care that Will and Jenny had access to. So we'll spend a little bit of time on that, and I'd like to now turn it over to Ms. Christy Artuso.
For the record, I'm Christy Artuso. I'm the Director of Neurosciences at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Co-chairs, committee members, thank you so much for the privilege of being here today. We made the decision to use the video to share with you, and by the way, this is a premiere on the video. It was just produced recently, and very few people have seen it. I've met Will. He's an awesome, awesome young man, but he suffered a traumatic brain injury that has changed his life. So I'd like the opportunity to introduce you to a few more patients. It's amazing to think that we have to talk about traumatic brain injury in this state, and yet we are the second most significant state in the country with traumatic brain injury and the leading for adolescents, children, and older adults. So let me introduce you to a 41-year-old male patient who was in Providence, Alaska Medical Center about 2.5 years ago. He suffered a traumatic brain injury associated with alcohol consumption. Surprising, we see that. He had multiple hospitalizations, uncountable acute care hospitalizations over a 22-month period, all in an acute care hospital, not where he needed to be, but it was the only place we had for him. Over $1.5 million in unreimbursed medical expenses. That's not the amount that we billed. That was the amount it cost us to deliver care in a setting that didn't meet his needs. He was an inpatient on every adult medical unit at Providence in Anchorage. He assaulted over 27 staff members. It was kind of tough to find a nurse that wanted to take care of him after a while. He contributed to 6 moderate disabilities among staff. He wasn't in the environment he needed to be in, but he had nowhere to go. He had no resources, no means to send him out of state, and we had nothing to offer him here. His acquired brain injury contributed to his eventual death. Traumatic brain injury is a growing public health care crisis. The human brain itself controls physical, cognitive, and behavioral functions. We're very, very focused in the medical industry on the physical functions, but it's the cognitive and the behavioral functions that we want to address for a few minutes here today. A traumatic brain injury can be a blow or a jolt to the head. It can be a penetrating head injury. Some of them are more dramatic than others. But it can impact one or more parts of the brain and temporarily or permanently disrupt normal function for an individual. But that'll never happen in Alaska, or not that often, right? We have a lot of fun in Alaska, and many people wear helmets. What I want you to really understand is that even people that wear helmets can suffer a traumatic brain injury. Will had a helmet on. TBIs are caused by falls, motor vehicle crashes, assaults, and other incidents. Shockwave blasts that are from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, rocket-propelled grenades, and landmines are the leading cause of TBI for our active-duty military personnel in combat zones. They can be as far as 100 feet away from one of these devices and still suffer a traumatic brain injury. We've not been very astute at diagnosing those. Let me share with you that I have been working in this area of nursing and medicine for over 25 years. I was young when I started. We didn't know then what we know today. So we've learned through research and through our observations that this type of brain injury needs time to heal, just like a broken leg does. Let me just ask you to think for a moment about this diagram. What do the different lobes of the brain do? And I won't bore you by reading it all to you, but just think about it for a moment. Problem solving, self-monitoring, personality and emotions. What would happen if one of those areas was broken? Think about the impact on your life. Think about the impact on your relationships. What about your work? How well would you perform your job for an injury that had no obvious outward signs and symptoms? We have no reason to be concerned in Alaska. Meet another patient of mine, Jonathan. I actually witnessed this accident. Jonathan is a 14-year-old adolescent, an A student, an awesome hockey player, enjoys the sport, lovely young man, polite, has a lot of ambition, playing on one of our top comp-level teams this year. Had a normal incident on the ice. I guess you could call it normal for those of you that have been around hockey longer than me. He was checked from behind, hit the boards hard. I actually thought he broke his neck. He did not. He did have a small spinal cord contusion from the injury. But the coaches told his parents, he got hit a little hard. He'll be okay. He played soccer the next night, and his soccer coach said to his mom, did something happen to Jonathan? And his mom called me because she said, I know you work with something involving the brain. What should I do? I asked her to have him checked. We did x-rays. We did a CAT scan. We were able to see the small contusion on his spinal cord. But the CAT scan of the brain didn't show us anything. His mom said to me, he's not right. He spilled his milk at breakfast. He hasn't done that since he was 2. Something is wrong. So Jonathan is now out of hockey for the year. We were able to test him with a program we have called the IMPACT program. It uses a computer-based cognitive test to test memory. And you heard before that memory is a major area. It tests your reaction time, and it's able to test some of those functions that I showed you on the diagram with the brain. And it's able to show us how impaired Jonathan was. Jonathan scored in less than the first percentile on all 4 areas of that test. Jonathan walked into the office. He looked fine. He was still polite. He is out of soccer for the year. His team's going to nationals. He's not going. He's unable to take tests or quizzes. He's required an individualized education plan. He's suffering now from clinical depression because he's devastated at this loss. And he had a helmet on. So it's not just about the proper gear, although that's tremendously important, but it's also about increasing our awareness, what we need to do. His parents are angry. His father is angry at me, and that's okay because he thinks we overreacted. We should let him skate. We should let him play with his friends because nothing will happen. There are 2 states in the United States that have both had second impact injuries resulting in death of an athlete on a field. I don't want Alaska to be the 3rd. And so we need to increase the awareness of the significance of impact-related mild and moderate concussions. Jonathan's is considered mild, a mild brain injury, versus Will's, which was a severe. And our biggest concern in Anchorage right now are the moderates. We have nowhere for them to go, and many of our military personnel have moderate brain injuries. So data from 2001 through 2005 indicate that about 100 per 100,000 patients in the state of Alaska suffer TBI. In the South Central region, it's double that, over 200 patients per 100,000. It is 2nd in the nation for the overall incidence, but leading for assault TBI, adolescent, and overt older patient TBI. 32% of completed suicides in this state have been associated with brain injury. In 2006, statewide, there were 66 children with TBI in special education. Think of the monies that we're spending to provide long-term support for patients when we could provide cognitive therapy and help them reach their potential much earlier. In prior military conflicts, you've heard TBI was present in about 14 to 20% of surviving casualties reports. About 13,000 service members in both of our military operations as of March 2007, we know that it's so much higher now. In peacetime, more than 7,000 individuals are admitted to military and veterans hospitals with TBI. There are no cognitive therapies here in Alaska unless an individual has the resources to purchase them. We do not have day programs for TBI patients. We do not have inpatient residential programs for TBI patients. I came from the state of New Jersey, and I love Alaska, so I'm here to stay. In New Jersey, we had these programs in existence. It was a way of life. They'd been around for years, decades even. We always referred our patients into rehabilitation services, specifically for traumatic brain injury patients. Now, why am I focusing on this patient population? Because they do not need the same rehabilitative services that we currently have. They need environmental services. Their environment has to be controlled. Why did my 41-year-old patient do so poorly? The inpatient acute care environment is not what he needs to recover. He needs a controlled environment with individuals who have been educated and taught to provide the supportive care and allow him to learn to reuse the parts of his brain that were not injured. It's specific therapy. We're working with Jonathan right now, and Jonathan is recovering, but it's specific therapy that allows that part of the brain to recover and rest. And so we need to raise awareness during this month and future months, as well as to look at opportunities to develop these programs. 2007 report from the Brain Injury Association of America, this is national, cites military sources identifying a lack of community-based services as a barrier to treatment. We have that here in Alaska. Stars and Stripes 2008 reports 1.1 million Americans have served. Up to 62% of the first wave of wounded soldiers that were treated at Walter Reed had a TBI. It's a huge number because of the changes in military. In 2006, the Department of Defense estimated that at least 10% have mild TBI. These are the ones we can't see. Frontline soldiers, they're estimating as high as 20%. So what's the cost of care? In 2006, Providence Alaska Medical Center, one healthcare provider in this state, saw 547 patients with a diagnosis of brain injury. In 2007, we saw over 700 patients, and we estimate over 800 per year, probably more. In the third quarter of 2008, patients with mild to moderate, non-hospitalized, non-severe, contributed to over $500,000 in hospital costs. Another targeted population are those patients with acquired brain injury, patients with stroke. Now, let me just share briefly with you that we are improving our level of stroke care here in Alaska as we speak. Last year, we developed a stroke program. It's one of the reasons they brought me into the picture. We just installed telemedicine carts in four cities in Alaska. We have four more to install. We're working on the information technology issues now. We have the first stroke neurologist ever in the state of Alaska. He came from Akron, Ohio in September of 2008. We will be linking patients in eight cities with that stroke neurologist and his team of neurologists to deliver care within 7 to 11 minutes of their arrival in any facility that we have a cart in. And we've only just started. We now have the ability to deliver intra-arterial thrombolytic therapy to patients with stroke. It had never been done in Alaska until last fall. We also have the ability to go in with special mechanical devices to retrieve clots in someone's brain done for stroke. It had never been done in Alaska, but these therapies have been in existence in the lower 48 for about 10 to 12 years. Why do I mention that? Because Alaska has not been able to deliver the level of care that the rest of the lower 48 has been doing for quite some time. And it's time that we do that for Alaskans. They deserve access to these services like anyone else in the United States of America. In Alaska, our mortality rates associated with stroke are higher than in the lower 48. We intend to impact that this year with our new program. So we're on a public service campaign. We're out talking about stroke, traumatic brain injury, prevention, recognition of symptoms, but we need to raise the awareness all over, and we need the support from our leaders in government to show that this is an issue that we intend to impact. In 2005, the CDC estimated that there were almost 3,000 stroke patients, with an estimated 8,000 in Alaska living with the effects of stroke. Stroke causes long-term disability in 90% of the patients in the state of Alaska. In a state that's been successful in launching a telemedicine access to care program, they've decreased that to 40 to 60%, depending on the severity. But we intend to do the same. It's very, very clear, given the population that we see, the numbers of patients, the returning military veterans, the types of sports that we participate in, and the activities in the state of Alaska, that we have a need for ongoing cognitive rehabilitative services here. Patients cannot be expected to go out of state to access these services, not only from a resource perspective, but their healing is impacted by being away from their families and their patients. Right, so we need to do what's necessary to help keep them in this state and to begin to launch a program. So how have we been doing? Well, believe it or not, since the Alaska Brain Injury Network has been innovative in their programs, we've actually seen improvements in the number of TBIs associated with motor vehicles, assault, bicycle, snow machine, pedestrian, sports, and suicide. So we've seen improvements in several areas because of the increase in public awareness. ATVs and falls are still on the downfall. They're still worsening. TBI associated with water sports is unchanged. So we're tracking the progress. We're watching the programs and seeing if what we do makes a difference. The national standard of care is early, intensive, acute treatment and rehabilitation. We have that in place in Alaska. Timely post-acute rehab of sufficient scope, duration, and intensity to restore maximum function to each of these individuals, to optimize their independence, to maintain good health throughout their lives. Individuals with brain injury must have access to a full continuum of care, as well as some intermittent, lifelong community-based information, resources, services, and supports. We provide the first, we don't provide the others. But the good news is, we have the providers in the state of Alaska who are qualified and capable and passionate about this level of care. And we would like to provide that level of care, but we have to be able to sustain it. The time to act is actually right now. We need to facilitate more public and private cooperation in all of the aspects: awareness, education, treatment, research, America's service members with TBI, and the millions of children and adults who are injured in the United States deserve no less. And the patients in Alaska deserve no less. So what do we need? We need treatment by an interdisciplinary team, which we have. In the past, the Department of Defense has contracted with the private sector clinicians rather than trying to replicate, so I don't think we need to worry about them trying to replicate these services that make up the full continuum of care of TBI. So we're working cooperatively with those agencies and with other organizations to develop a continuum of care for TBI patients in Alaska. Currently, Providence Alaska Medical Center is working with Matsu Health Services, which is a large behavioral health organization in the Valley, to collaboratively develop a day program and a residential program for TBI patients. But before we are able to fully develop that program, we need to know that we're going to be able to sustain it. And sustainability means we're going to have a funding source for Medicaid-eligible patients who can access these care resources.
And let me just interject real quickly that a few weeks ago, Senator McGuire introduced legislation, Senate Bill 118, relating to medical assistance for traumatic brain injury services. And some of the components to that would be to target this population, to identify the services needed for this population and a reimbursable schedule for that, and then also to develop an appropriate assessment tool, how to get them eligible for the program. And so what Christy's going to speak to next is how the waiver program or having a Medicaid funding source for rehabilitative care is going to help Providence and others develop those programs here in Alaska.
What we found through research is that 23 other states have Medicaid waivers, and it's a foundation. It's a way to start to get these programs off the ground. You know that the CDC has recognized that TBI is a problem nationwide, and waivers can be developed under the authority of Section 1915C of the Social Security Act to help Medicaid-eligible individuals who might otherwise be admitted to a hospital or nursing facility live independently in the community, and that's our goal. We don't want to admit them to the acute care hospitals. We want to facilitate their return to their communities, their work, their families. Since 1991, almost 20 years, 23 states have recognized that need. Many have multiple waivers that provide resources for home and rehabilitative services, so these are specifically targeted to the TBI network, and some for also spinal cord injury patients. New Jersey had both waivers in place. The reason is that in many TBI patients do not meet Medicaid eligibility because there's nothing you can see. They can walk, they can talk, they can feed themselves. They're not eligible. What we're asking is to redefine that eligibility and to look at a waiver that would allow them to be eligible for services beyond. And as a legislature, if you set that standard, then the private payers come right on the bandwagon because it's the expected norm. Waivers were established because the states lacked the capacity to provide these special services to individuals with brain injury. So they've been the stimulus for these waivers over the years. And the waiver is actually the key element. Two of the states cited building their service capacity as the primary reason for the waiver, not even linking the fact that their patients had gone out of state and they wanted to bring them back. We had someone come up from one of the states with a waiver and look at Alaska, and the first thing he said was, "Do you really need a waiver?" He said, "That'll get you off the ground and get you started." So we're looking to the experts. We're not going to reinvent a system. There are many good ones out there. We've been working with several of them throughout the lower 48 to see what's needed in Alaska and how we can best deliver this model of care. Six states reported that prior to their waiver, Medicaid-eligible individuals were frequently placed in specialized high-cost facilities outside the state. That serves no one. The decision to establish waivers in these states was also an effort to bring the citizens back to their home states and keep them with their families. So why now? It's a population-based initiative. It's based on the people of Alaska, what they need and deserve. It's a proactive response. We've already established the significance here and the associated disabilities. The Brain Injury Network has developed a 10-year plan. The plan is in place. Why wait for litigation? It's happened in a few other states. I think we don't want to go there. And we do want to keep our patients here. It's expensive, and it does not help them recover. We're disabling families when we allow them to go out of state. And the only ones that go out of state are those that have the resources to pay for it, because we don't have the programs here. We are committed to developing these programs, but we need your help and your support as we bring this legislation forward, and your support in your own communities as we try to increase awareness. I need your support with all the hockey dads. I think I've got the moms on my side.
I guess at this time, well, maybe if there's more to your presentation.
That was it.
That's okay, well, that's probably time to ask questions. I'm going to I know I got the committee's waiver expert will probably have a question here, the rules chairman, but I guess I'll kind of warm it up with some relatively smaller questions. Is you probably don't have any of us as patients or your Providence, maybe not, but you know, when I was 14 I had a football concussion, and I don't know how many concussions I've had since. But if you were just to look at us, we're a demographic here, anybody in the room, how many brain injuries does an average person have in their lifetime?
I don't know that that statistic has ever been really published per se, and I'll tell you why. We didn't recognize them as a brain injury prior to only a few years ago. So those concussions where Dad said, get back out there, in my case it was get back up on the horse, let him throw you again, you know, get back on the football field, don't take that from him, go get him again. That philosophy in our society has masked our awareness. So I don't believe that we really understood the impact. There are different levels of severity. We never tested you at the time. So now that we have tests, which are relatively new, now that we have tests, they can actually show us the change in function in the person's brain, and they show us that it impacts their success in school. And these are things we weren't aware of years ago. So I don't think I can really answer that question significantly, because I've never read it published how many an individual, it would depend on your activity level. I would say most of us have probably had a traumatic brain injury of some sort, but the circumstances may have been that you took a week off or 2 weeks off, or maybe you didn't and you just didn't get hit again.
So to follow up that is that you know, of course, we've had workplace injuries legislation in the past, carpals, you know, that people have that get on the top of their hands. So can you talk a little bit, we have other questions to follow, but is minor repetitive injuries to your brain, I mean, it's a significant organ in your body, but is it like a carpal injury?
Meaning that with repeated impacts, does it get worse?
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, relatively, relatively tiny injuries to your brain. So
you can cover it. Go ahead.
There is a few articles that were just written, and they are based on concussions of NFL players. And these are NFL players who are now in their 40s and they're retired, and five of them have died. And they've been able to do autopsies on their brain. And a lot of them, one died of suicide, one, they've all had problems with having family members leave them. So they're all at a state of not in a happy place when they leave. And they've gone and autopsied their brain, and they have found that there is on the inside, deep on the inside of the brain, there is damage that you could see. They look like an 80-year-old with dementia at that point. And so there's damage physically to the brain due to just the multiple concussions.
One final question before I go to other committee members is, one of the interesting statistics you said, you know, is we hear it all the time, we're either number one in the nation or we're number 50 in the nation when it comes to any kind of stat. And you said that we're leading the nation in TBI injuries amongst teenagers. Is that because we're a relatively small population, is that because we do a good job of reporting those injuries, or why are we number one or two?
I think over the past 10 years, most states have a trauma registry where these injuries are reported, so that's a common practice now that wasn't in place before. We do have a younger population overall that's very physically active, and I think one of the reasons we lead the nation is because of the types of sports that are commonplace with the number of people we have living in the state, as well as their youth. So because of the activities, as I showed you just the slide very quickly, the activities, the youth that we have in the state, as well as the numbers of potential for accidents, our potential is higher. Therefore, it does make sense that we would have more. But we also have that large native population in the villages. Many of them do not wear helmets, so the severity of those injuries is much more significant, and we do report all of those.
Okay, I'll see if there's other questions, but we do have two people that wish to testify on this presentation. Representative Coghill, did you have a waiver question?
We could do the waiver question now or later. I got several questions, so to let the other people testify, okay, if that's your wish, Mr. Chairman, because okay. I got at least this many.
Oh, wow. Okay, at this time, we'll invite, we have two people that wish to comment on this presentation. First of all, we'll start with Christine in Anchorage. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Hello, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Christine DeCourtney, and while I'm representing probably traumatic brain injury people in Alaska, I also have worked for the Alaska Tribal Health System for the last 20 years, both in the bush and in Anchorage, so I am very much aware of the number of accidents that occur. I suffered two traumatic brain injuries 11 months apart. The first was a bicycle accident on one of the Anchorage trails. I broke my helmet and was knocked out and required 50 facial stitches. The second accident 11 months later was a car-van encounter while I was stopped at a stop sign in downtown Anchorage. The plastic surgeon had done such a great job, I didn't look like I'd had an accident before, and I had no visible injuries in this accident. But it soon became evident to me and people I worked with that something was wrong. And it was very wrong as I tried to carry on my work and my personal life. I managed multiple grants and projects, and I could no longer keep my words straight, much less my work. I believe that if I hadn't taken the initiative to seek out healthcare providers who didn't believe drugs and disability were the answers to my TBI and supported my efforts to combine Western medicine and complementary therapy, I would not be working today. Instead, I would probably be addicted to drugs and on disability. You know, my search for answers took me to books, consultations from outside Alaska, and constant internet searches trying to find answers for these symptoms that I had experienced. Finally, I found an innovative new program in Anchorage with Dr. Adam Grove, who works with a brain expert outside of Alaska to diagnose traumatic brain injuries and the part of the brain they affect. I did some special tests, both written, that I've been through many times before, but also a special EEG was given. The results of all those tests were sent outside to a specialist who compared them against a number of other areas. And as a result, an individual cognitive rehabilitation program was set up for me. If you haven't had a TBI, you won't maybe not understand this, but finally I had a definitive answer that I indeed had major areas of difficulties in my brain. I wasn't crazy. And I was told, you know, in no uncertain terms, having a second head injury that soon on top of the first one caused many more complications. You know, and after working with this cognitive therapy program for several months, I recently had a follow-up EEG and a repeat of all the baseline tests. The differences, even to the outside consultants, were amazing. I have been able to do much more work. I can manage all my projects better. I have better balance as well as better energy. And I really believe that, you know, I had a lot of incentive to keep looking and looking for answers, but I didn't find them in Alaska very much. And in fact, finally someone referred to me. I spoke with somebody out of state, a paid for a consultation, who found a neuro optometrist. Who found that I didn't have any peripheral vision. That's why I was kind of chinking the corners of my car afterwards. But nobody ever suspected that. So I think everybody in Alaska, you know, who's walking around, and you can't tell if they've had TBIs, that they really deserve an opportunity to find resources within Alaska that is going to help with traumatic brain injuries. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Christine. For the second person on the network, can we go to Patricia Chapman? Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, this is Pat Chapman in Ketchikan, Alaska, and I'm here speaking on behalf of our brain injury support group here in Ketchikan and my own personal family. I have a 20-year-old daughter who is in her third year with her severe TBI. There's been so much testimony that's been so good, it just makes me want to almost move to Anchorage. But here in Ketchikan, we are zero with experts with TBIs, and yet we have hundreds of people here with TBIs. I happen to be one of the people that collect the trauma data for the state of Alaska, and it's amazing what we have. But to speak on the waiver itself, we were lucky. My daughter was so severe, she got into the developmental disabled waiver. She had a brain injury. Brain injuries are different than developmentally disabled. So when I brought her home, just to think, she could use one hand and lift it a little bit to type on her augmentive device that would speak for her, and it would take her a half hour to write out a couple sentences to say what she needed. She could think, but she couldn't get it out. And then she'd get tired and have to take a nap. Well, according to the waiver for the disabled, developmentally disabled, the care providers couldn't take care of her when she needed to take a nap. We had a horrible time. I still tried to work, and I would have to come home if she was going to take a nap and she didn't wake up in 10 or 15 minutes, because those people weren't supposed to be there to take care of her. And that's wrong. TBIs are specialized. They need a different type of care. And even at this time, my daughter's now in the third year. She wanted to come in and testify today, but she also wanted to go and work with the community activity here in the community for wellness within a community, and she had to take a choice, and it was really hard. And I told her I would explain to you that she had to make a choice, and she felt that she would help her community more by going there. The other thing I want to bring out is that bringing our children home, we took her to Seattle. We were there for, I think, 2 or 3 months, and then we went back for another month, and we just came back from another month and a half down there where I took her for specialized care because there's nothing up here. But in the community itself, we find that the people with brain injuries actually recover better if they have their community support. There is nothing that will ever, ever replace having your neighbors and your peers and the other community members there with them and giving them that mental and sometimes physical support, but mostly it's just emotional. We have a lack of neuropsychologists or neuro counselors, anybody that knows about brain injuries. My daughter has severe emotional problems right now. She gets angry with, just you say one word wrong and she's angry. And then 5 minutes later, she'll apologize for losing her temper. You go to anybody here and all they want to give her is some kind of drugs. They don't want to find out and work with her on her brain injury. And we need that. I work with many brain injured people here in Ketchikan and as a support group. I have no experience other than I had a brain injury as a child, but just what I find on the internet and what Jill and Jennifer up in Anchorage can help with, and try to find answers and solutions for people for getting help. Some of these people have never received help. They didn't know where to go because there is no place. They go to a psychiatrist here, they put them on drugs. They go to a counselor, the counselor tells them they need to go back and work on it. Many of our people, many, many, which are Alaska Natives as well as Filipinos, Spanish derivative, Caucasian, all of walks of the life, both financially and otherwise, turn to drugs and alcohol. I see these people coming in to the ER, beat up and smashed, not because they're alcoholics. Yes, they are now, but they weren't before. They had a brain injury. They can't function, so they try to self-medicate. We need to help these young people before they destroy their life. They can, and they will, with our help, become functional, capable members within the community. And I just really, from the bottom of my heart, ask you to look and find funding to help these people. And I thank you all very, very much.
Thank you, Pat. And then on behalf of the committee, send our gratitude to your daughter for helping out in the community. At this time, we will close public testimony and return to the committee. And Mr. Rolls-Chair, do you have some questions, please?
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and thank you, ladies, for coming to the committee. In looking at the history of from the Department of Health and Social Services to where you are today as the network incorporated, the issue of the waiver certainly came through that discussion somewhere along the line. So what has been the action? And I guess just for whatever it's worth for the committee members, Medicaid has general rules to go by, and a waiver gets you outside of those rules. And so we have a home and community-based waiver that the one lady talked about her daughter was able to get, which allowed for some certain care under certain conditions. So, and the conditions would be asked to either be amended or a waiver change. So you've been working at it for a number of years, probably from 2003 to now has been your biggest effort. Help me understand, has there been resistance? Has it been just the terminology? Has it been the network of capacity in Alaska?
Well, I've been with the Brain Injury Network for 3 years. From my understanding, the Brain Injury Network was an organization back in 2001. It's called the Alaska Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Board then. I do know that they have made the recommendation for a traumatic brain injury since the very beginning when they did a needs assessment for Alaska. My understanding is that there just hasn't been action moving towards either improving the existing Medicaid program or having an additional waiver. Alaska has some really good waivers, and we know that, but there's three issues of why they haven't supported people with brain injuries. One is that the eligibility criteria to get in is really based on physical. It's not based on whether you need supervision or whether you have a memory or cognition disability. The second aspect is it doesn't cover the cognitive therapy component and some of the very basic brain injury services. And the third is the level of care issue. And I understand from the department, I do know that we have some folks in the audience from Senior Disability Services, but it's been talked about that the level of care would have to change. From my understanding and from a Rutgers study, 118 pages, a survey of Medicaid brain injury programs, and what other states have done is that they have amended and included an additional level of care so that more people with brain injuries could access the waivers. And so at the moment, to this point, I do know Senate Bill 61 had some recommendations through HCBS strategies, and they really weren't very concrete recommendations, and they didn't give the department a lot of direction to move from.
Mr. Chairman, the department is the one that actually has to do the application for the waiver, and then the individuals have to work at qualifying. And so I'm curious, is the department looking for more information on the ability to provide services in Alaska, or are they going to, and maybe this is for the department, but from your perspective, I think it's important for us to know, is it because doctors generally are not aware or able to diagnose to the level that you'd have to define down into a waiver, or is it that the care that is going to be the probably the developmental part of care is not well defined enough?
I think it's the latter, that the level of care that these patients need is not well defined in the existing waivers. But more importantly, these patients, most of them do not meet the current definition of disability to qualify for the Medicaid waiver. In other words, it looks at true functional disability. It does not include cognitive thinking disability. And yet most of our mild, moderate, and even the severe brain-injured patients may not have functional disability. They have cognitive disabilities that impact their life for the rest of their life, and they can be, as you saw from one of our patients, 8 to 10 years of rehabilitative therapy to succeed. So that piece is not defined in the existing language, and so they're, even though the doctors may define them as a mild brain injury, and now we have our physicians, yes, they are referring to the IMPACT program where we can define the cognitive illness, but they don't meet the criteria because we don't recognize cognitive disability as significant as the functional disability. And I think we have to raise that awareness that it is a disability that you may not be able to see, but that now we have evidence-based tests that can document that, which we did not have 20 years ago. So we can document that level of cognitive disability, but it's not included. So it wouldn't matter how severe it was. They wouldn't meet the criteria.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just to, for what it's worth, and I'm going to open up a different can of worms that goes alongside this, and that is that we have in some of our assisted living homes people who have dying brains, and it's called Alzheimer's. And so the question then is, how do we deal with the first the acute problem of a brain injury or that, and a dying brain? And we have not been able to properly define either one, I think. And so I think to have one go without the other going is going to be part of the problem.
Well, Alzheimer's is a chronic debilitating condition that is progressive. I think the important thing to realize is by today's standards and with today's medical knowledge, Alzheimer's ends in death. It is progressive, it does not reverse, and we cannot treat it. Those patients do require support, and there are some programs out in the lower 48 that we would like to also incorporate in Alaska that provide additional information about how to best work with Alzheimer's patients and provide an environment that is safe for them. But it's a very, very different type of care. So Alzheimer's patients very often do very well in assisted living facilities as long as those facilities are knowledgeable about the level of care that they need. But Alzheimer's is a progressive disorder. It will continue to get worse as of today's standards. We have medications that will slow the progression but will not cure it. And eventually that individual, their brain will die, just like you described it. A traumatic brain injury results in an injury that can heal. And at times, the level of healing is going to vary with the severity of that brain injury, but it can heal given time and cognitive therapy. As you heard from one of the patients, she works on memory exercises. These are therapeutic exercises that have to be taught and repeated. You heard Will say he doesn't like his therapy. It's boring. It's not fun. As we look at Jonathan, Jonathan has had to embark in some cognitive therapy exercises to really allow his brain to heal. So we can facilitate healing in a traumatic brain injury. With Alzheimer's, we facilitate a protective environment. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, I only brought it up because the dilemma that we end up with at this side of the table is they both require payment of services, and the federal government, for example, under Medicare, is not going to acknowledge some of the Alzheimer's issues where they end up falling on the state. And so that puts the tension on us trying to get another waiver. So that does become an issue. But so that's just the technical side of how do we proceed with this. So I will reserve my other questions for some others, maybe get to them. But I will ask some more questions on how do we get there for some of the waiver description.
And through the chair, if I just might answer Representative Conkill's question regarding the Alzheimer's issue. The Brain Injury Network has recommended that the language be cognitive disability, and we're working with Senator McGuire's office so that it is not just traumatic brain injury, and so that we are looking towards that cognitive component.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Chairman, because some of the care issues are going to be similar.
Mm-hmm.
One is obviously palliative, one is healing. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, we have two over here, and then we'll return to Representative Coghill, Representative Cisna, then Representative Lynn, then Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be that one of the terms that I just talked to the department yesterday. Excuse me, but there's a lot happening here. Wasn't aimed at traumatic brain injury, but nonetheless, that same business of people who wind up being at home and many times with caregivers who are oftentimes family members, friends, who are trying to be able to take care of them, need to have somebody at home all the time for that person. They can't be there because they work. And I personally have had some of my own constituents that have had to drop their job in order to take care of that person, and then wind up so much in economic trouble that they have to send them to some kind of institution, and sometimes it's not in state. And the term that was apparently is being played with is the term for another thing besides personal care attendant is universal worker, I think it is, something like that. The idea that we have people in homes that can be there so that people can be at work. They wouldn't be a therapeutic person. They would be the person that would know if someone was falling asleep and they shouldn't, was getting up when they shouldn't, that kind of thing. And then I'd like to know if that would fill that. I have another follow-up question, if I could.
Through the chairman, I don't feel compelled to say that, yes, that would fulfill it because of my clinical background. That is not the type of care that we would want to deliver to this population. This population would be better served in a daycare environment where we could provide an 8-hour therapeutic environment for a group of patients that are structured specifically for their needs. So keeping them at home with and I'm just going to use a different term, a babysitter, somebody who's just watching to keep them safe, is not going to provide them cognitive therapy to allow them to improve, although it may seemingly fill a void in the state. I don't believe it's the best practice, and that is not the evidence-based national practice that I'm accustomed to. We would normally send these patients who are capable of staying at home to a day program, that would allow them to work on exercises that would then rebuild the parts of their brain that have been injured and or allow the healthy parts of their brain to recover. And those day programs are much more economical than having one person for every person in the home because they're group settings, and that's what we're looking to develop here in Alaska.
I'll follow up and then to Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other one is that we live in a state where people oftentimes, it's not the best idea, but they wind up going back home because that's who can take care of them. And out back home is maybe a very remote area. Yet I've been out in very remote areas, and telemedicine, telepsychiatry is being used. Could that ever be something that you could do with this kind of problem, a therapeutic program?
Absolutely. We are considering using telemedicine and telepsychiatry. With the initiation of the telemedicine program in the non-Native facilities, and then the plan is to partner with the Native facilities and link our services with theirs, but that's ongoing. So this is a brand new program. And we are definitely, it's on the horizon to use that for telepsychiatry. But our idea also was to create the first model residential and daycare program in the South Central area where the largest population of patients are, create a model that would work, and then ideally create smaller models out in the village areas or in other areas with identified need like Ketchikan, et cetera, where we could then provide the services and take them to the patient. And one of the models that we've looked at in Texas utilized average individuals to really work in those facilities. They were educated, trained, but not necessarily licensed professionals. So that bridges a different gap, too, where we could provide work opportunities for individuals in those villages, and we would provide the training to help them. But we've got to get a program started so we can develop that model, evaluate it, make sure it works, and then move it on forward throughout the state.
Thank you. We have three in the queue now, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, and then Representative Seaton. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Help me understand, if you would, the difference between a traumatic brain injury, perhaps, where you know the head is struck, and the acquired brain injury, such as a stroke or mini-stroke, or what do you call it, the transient type. So what is the principal difference here? I understand, like maybe, you know, both cases, blood may exert pressure on the brain tissue, but what's the principal difference in the therapy for that? Now I'm not limiting that to just the ability to walk and talk and so on.
I could have a lot of fun right here, but I'll restrain myself. We could talk about the cellular physiology, but we won't today. So what happens in a stroke is that a stroke results in a decrease in oxygen and nutrient supply to an area of the brain for a variety of reasons. So those brain cells don't get what they need to function. They cease functioning. They become injured and or dead. When they're dead, they don't conduct an impulse the way they're supposed to. Think of an electrical current going between a positive and negative electrode. Very, very similar in microscopic cells in the brain, where the actual message, the impulse, jumps from one point to another.
It synapses.
Exactly. It synapses from one point to another. So in a stroke, those cells are injured. They've not gotten what they need. They don't conduct it normally. In a brain injury, what happens from the impact is that those impulses are the axons, the actual tissue that runs down the cell is sheared. So it's no longer the conductive tissue it needs to be. Two different types of injuries that result sometimes in the same type of cognitive disability or a similar cognitive disability. Now, to answer the second part of your question, it's not always the same type of therapy. Every person is different, and their response to that stroke or acquired brain injury or traumatic brain injury is going to be unique to that individual. But some of the therapies will help both types of individuals recover areas of the brain and give them chances to really redevelop those synapses, or we will retrain another area of the brain to compensate for what they've lost. Does that answer?
I think it does somewhat. So basically, trying to get other parts of the brain to take over, or perhaps just self-repairs.
Exactly, or allow healing.
And it could happen either for the stroke or for the traumatic, and some therapies could be the same or at least overlap some.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. questions are generating questions, so we have Representative Coghill, Representative Seaton, and Representative Holmes.
Don't have to answer now. All I want to know is we're talking mostly at this point about a systems approach from the state level funding and the delivery level. What is happening in the professional level when you see people at EMS, at the ER, and the nurses who get to see the patient at the first glance?
Currently, EMS brings them into an emergency room setting, depending on the area they're in, or we dispatch flight crews to bring them into the Anchorage area where we have most of the sophisticated equipment that's able to diagnose. We first rule out a physical injury to the brain, which would be bleeding on the brain, something we can see, a skull fracture, et cetera. If we don't see any of those, depending on the patient's mental status, we admit them to the hospital for a brief period of evaluation. 24, 48, or 72 hours is the average. If they have no physical injury, meaning no blood on the brain, nothing that we can physically see, they're discharged and oftentimes referred to the IMPACT program where we do cognitive screening. After that point, though, we have limited resources to refer them to. We don't have daycare programs for cognitive therapy, and our neuropsychologists have to bill for their services, so that if they don't have funding available or if their private insurer does not pay for those services, then they're left for out-of-pocket expenses, which are astronomical.
And Mr. Chairman, no disrespect, but that's Providence, probably. And there's a lot of other places in Alaska that don't have the continuum of care that you just outlined.
That's true.
And so
you're referring
so generally
to outside
speaking,
Alaska.
Right.
Many of the severe brain injuries and moderate brain injuries are transferred to Anchorage.
Okay.
Right. That does happen pretty consistently. So we do get a lot of the patients from the village with severe brain injury. But then we send them back out. And at that point, we lack the continuum of care.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, there's a lot we could talk about here, but that's the beginning of the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're talking about cognitive therapy as being a certain design therapy or a certain program, or are you talking about cognitive therapy as being anything that we're doing on thinking and learning? I mean, we keep talking about cognitive therapy, but I haven't heard the definition. Maybe I missed it, but
there are quite a few. There are quite a few different types and models of cognitive therapy. We don't follow one specific type, and usually cognitive therapies as a group are designed to meet the needs of a particular patient and how they present. The brain is exceptionally complex. Patients with mild brain injury, 100 patients will present 100 different ways with 100 different disabilities and need 100 different types of therapy. What's important to recognize is that those therapies are customized to that person's need based on the tests that we now have available.
Okay. Just to follow up, and then Representative Holmes, then batting cleanup is the co-chair.
I guess, you know, I'm trying to figure out what we're dealing with then, because we're talking about a whole lot of different ways of dealing with a whole lot of different things that are that may or may not be diagnosed by certain tests, but that there's identified a cognitive disability, and whether you can define or not, whether you can see or not a physical disruption in the brain with the test before you send people out, seems like there's a level of cognitive disability, and I'm trying to figure out, does that mean someone, if you test them on a scale of learning, they're less than average? How much less than average before they qualify for a waiver? And how do we identify that this, because we're talking about any cognitive disability, not one just caused by traumatic brain injury. We're talking about, I mean, according to what we were talked about before, it's fetal alcohol syndrome. It's anything that has basically done something with the brain that has diminished it. How far below average, or how far below their previous functioning? And if we don't have a measure that, I'm just in limbo land as far as what our definition of this cognitive disability is that would kick in this waiver for cognitive therapy.
I think I can answer that question a little bit more clearly. Currently, the way we test for cognitive disability with one particular test that has been validated and is accepted nationally, the IMPACT test, the results of that test do not equate to a developmental disability on the same scale. And therefore, it's not their IQ test or their developmental disability test may be unchanged. But the impact test may show that they have severe impairment of verbal memory, severe impairment of short-term memory, severe impairment of visual memory, meaning they pass a stop sign and forget whether they're supposed to stop or not. So current memory is impaired more than the developmental disability test that we've been using for many, many decades. So they're two different measures. They can't be compared. And I think that's why we're seeking some guidance on the appropriate verbiage in a waiver, and they're currently rewording it, because the current test that would qualify, as she said, her daughter qualified as a developmental disability because she had a severe brain injury. But many people do not qualify as developmentally disabled, but yet they have cognitive disabilities that are documented and identified by evidence-based, researched tests, but they don't meet our current language, so they don't qualify for benefits.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had two questions. The first is just trying to figure out where these are happening. We have a slide that says that roughly 100 reported cases between 2001 and 2005, approximately 100 reported cases per 100,000 people statewide, mm-hmm. and about a little more than double that in South Central. And then I thought we saw a slide, and unfortunately I don't have it in front of me, that talked about a lot of these occurring actually in rural Alaska. So on the, is that accident-based? Where are these happening, and where are they being reported?
100 per 100,000 in the entire state of Alaska.
Uh-huh.
Your population is concentrated in South Central. So 200 out of 100,000 are in the South Central region, because that's where your population is concentrated. 34% of all brain injuries involve Alaska Natives. Okay, so the Alaska Native population, not necessarily in the villages. One of the things we said was that some of the severe TBIs associated with ATVs mm-hmm. occurs in the villages.
So you have, Mr. Chairman, if I may, so you have maybe a higher number in South Central, because that's where the population is, but a higher rate outside of Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Right.
Just, and a second question, Mr. Chairman, was one of the other slides talking about the waiver said that we've talked about how we don't really have the continuum of care and the services here, largely because there's no way for most people to pay for it, and so that the waiver is a one way to help encourage the buildup of the services. Could you give us just a real brief, we've touched on some of these, or like the daycare and the things like that, but what sorts of services and where would you expect to see grow up if a waiver were instituted?
I can speak to what we've already begun the process of looking at with Providence, is partnering with Mat-Su Health Services and developing a daycare program that would provide services for 60 to 100 patients per month initially, and then we would grow that program and add a residential component for 5 to 10 residential patients, and at that point evaluate the success of the program and look at where we needed to grow capacity, meaning do we need to continue to grow it in the valley where we do have space, or do we continue to grow it in smaller pods throughout the village areas. So we want to grow one program that meets both daycare, cognitive therapy, and residential services for brain-injured patients in the South Central region, largest population, where the providers are located currently, and then based on its success, move out into some of the other underserved regions. And also at the same time, remember the stroke program is moving forward. That's a totally separate program that will then come back in and allow us to link neuropsych services through the telemedicine carts to other areas in Alaska. So both programs are going to link together. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Co-Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned Mat-Su Health Facility working with Providence. But my real question is, do community health centers, are they a little positioned differently to, or is a waiver still needed for them? I know Mary Alice in the Mat-Su Community Health Center there is looking at expanding to include long-term care cognitive therapy center for TBI. So is a health center, community health center, better positioned to receive reimbursement for the services?
Yes, absolutely. They require the waiver as well. And Mary Alice has been working with us, and one of the key components in her business plan is the accomplishment of the Medicaid waiver that would start the funding process for sustainability.
Follow-up?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Are there other community health centers looking this direction?
Mary Alice actually surveyed a number of community health centers, and none of them were interested in pursuing this entire program development at the time. And she and I were linked through the Brain Injury Network as two facilities that had voiced an interest in meeting the needs of this population. So she has communicated with other healthcare centers, and they were not interested at this time in moving their own services forward to meet this need. Perhaps they didn't have the resources, didn't feel that they had the expertise. I don't know the actual reasons, but I do know that she did survey all areas, and we've had several discussions about working collaboratively to try to meet the needs of the population.
One last question.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
What state is number one? Is this a matter of curiosity? I can't help myself.
Through the chair, when it comes to the brain injury numbers, they really are changing on a regular basis. And how we've started to look at it is a trend over time. And so we talk about, Brain Injury Network talks about numbers over a five-year average compared to the previous five-year average. And so it just kind of depends on which study you look to see who's number one.
I see. Because you said we were number two, so I thought with our active lifestyle, I mean, what state could beat us out in the active lifestyle arena?
I can tell you that two pioneer states, New Jersey and Texas, both suffered traumatic brain injury fatalities and prompted their legislature to really take a firm hold on this as a statewide problem and increase awareness in the communities.
Thank you.
And through the chair, I just had one point to address to Representative Keller regarding the behavioral health centers. When Alaska received the federal grant for TBI back in 1999, they chose MHDD, Mental Health DD, as the lead agency, and which is now behavioral health. They required all behavioral health centers to screen for brain injury at that point, and right around 32% of new clients in behavioral health center have history of brain injury. What they have been finding since then, though, is the recognition of what to do next. How do we move that person to the next level? On the behavioral health side, they really do specialize in the cognitive, behavioral, emotional aspects, but they don't bring in the speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy components. And so it really would take a collaborative effort to provide the right supports for Alaskans. And behavioral health centers with the right training could be an area where some better counseling component could be brought in.
Thank you.
Okay, one final question before we close. Yes, go ahead, Reverend Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've still got maybe 5 minutes, but anyway, on the training part, there again is one of those, it sounds like rural Alaska is one of the problems too, and that telemedicine cart oftentimes is used in very remote places as a training tool. So is there any discussion in with the University of Alaska Anchorage or ABU or something like that on the curricula to do that kind of thing?
And through the chair, Representative Sisna, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has been supportive of brain injury training money. We came to the legislature last year and we were hoping that it would be a general fund mental health requests so that it could be at a level where we could continue the training. What we've done is worked with Center for Human Development. Right now, we've developed an intro to brain injury curriculum that's supposed to start next month. And the idea is to take 15 leaders from around the state, develop their knowledge around brain injury, teach them how to be mentors, and teach them how to be the point of contact in their community. Right now, the trust is fully funding that project. It's going to be one class, but we are applying for federal monies to help that project continue for school programs, for vocational programs, for healthcare providers, for head injury support groups, for case managers. There is some definitely more training that can be done to best support our workforce on this issue.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Christy. On behalf of the entire committee, we appreciate this. This is a very important issue, and hopefully we can learn from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your
time. Our next committee meeting will be held Thursday, 3 p.m., March 12th, on the agenda. Nurse overtime, House Bill 50, and stillborn births, House Bill 2. Okay, we are adjourned at 4:57.